Good morning and welcome to Locus Hocus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In May, the U.S. District Court in Portland, Oregon, issued its long-awaited ruling on the federal government's Columbia Snake River Salmon Plan. U.S. District Judge Michael Simon blasted the 2014 biological opinion issued by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration as inadequate. He not only rendered the agency, as well as its partners, the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation, to start over, but also said the new effort must follow the National Environmental Policy Act and suggested it should consider breaching one or more of the Snake River dams as a viable alternative to saving the iconic fish. This morning, my guest is Dan Cherry, Communications Director for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, who will tell us why this is good news for salmon and the health of the Columbia River system. Dan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, this feels like deja vu. I think I've done this show about four times already. Each time the government comes up with a salmon plan, which ignores the dams, it ignores habitat issues,
right,
and it says, let's kill the seals. This time it's let's kill the cormorants.
Right.
And then the judge denies the plan and says, you need to go back and start all over again. So is there anything different this time?
Well, this time we think that there are four things that are different this time. And the fact that we have been through this so many other times is part of the frustration in that we have been through this time and time and time again, and it just keeps going back to the same old things, and then it keeps getting rejected again. And the only species that keep losing in this consistently are the salmon and the steelhead, because they're not getting the things done that they need to get done. So this time, we think that we may have some things that are different in that Judge Simon is in. He's new and he's young, and he will be on the bench hopefully for a long time. And in his first shot at this, roundly rejected their plan at recovering native runs of salmon and steelhead. And so we think that that's a significant barrier for any other action going forward, as far as they know that if they do not meet the needs of the native salmon and steelhead, then their plan is going to get rejected again. And they know this, and this will happen again and again and again until something happens.
Well, I was under the impression that the other judge's decisions also said that this is not addressing the needs of salmon and steelhead, and that it wasn't sufficient, and you needed to look at other habitat issues and not just blame some outside force. So I'm wondering, what is making this different from the previous decisions?
Well, there's other external factors going on as well. If you look at the energy markets, they're kind of trending towards each other as far as the cost of renewables and the cost of burning fossil fuels and more harmful means of producing energy. They're kind of moving, they're trending towards each other as far as renewables are getting cheaper to make. And so when you look at examples from across the nation, as far as, well, maybe not necessarily across the nation, but at least in the Northwest, you look at the Elwha Dam, you look at the four dams on the Klamath that are going to be coming out within the next decade or two, and you see that energy companies are saying, well, it's cheaper for us to remove the dams than it is to retrofit the dams to meet fish passage standards.
Well, actually, it's kind of ironically, because hydro is considered a renewable resource. So it's not exactly in the same category as fossil fuels.
Right.
But what's the problem with hydro that maybe puts it almost in the same antiquated shelf as fossil fuels?
Right. Well, salmon and steelhead are, it's still better than the alternative, right? There's no arguing with that. But salmon and steelhead in particular are cold water fish, and they require cold, swiftly moving water to be able to survive. And when you back that water up, you give that water a chance to warm on the surface. You give it a chance to breed different kinds of algae and other organisms that wouldn't necessarily be able to breed. And you also force fish to either run a fish ladder when they're an adult, or on the way downstream, you force out-migrating smolts to run through a turbine. And we know that that has an extremely high mortality rate on out-migrating smolts. And so by changing our practices, we could even, so let's say around 5 years ago or so, plaintiffs got together and got a court injunction to increase the amount of spill on some of the dams in the Snake River system. And now, 5 or so years later, we're seeing runs of fall Chinook more than a million. I mean, more than we've seen since the 1930s, and since the dams were put in place. And we see that just by letting smolts go over the dam as opposed to forcing them to pass through the moving turbines, you increase their survivability by an enormous margin. And so we see things like this where we have verifiable instances of success by changing our hydro management practices, and not all of them are necessarily difficult or expensive.
Well, why is it that we talk about improving the fish passage in the main stem dams on the Columbia River? On the Snake River, the talk has been, as long as I have been in Oregon, about breaching the dams. So why should those dams be breached while the ones on the Columbia can stay in place?
Well, I'm no expert on dam management, but from the way I understand it, it does seem that there's a cost benefit that is looked at as far as, it was the impact of leaving that dam in place greater than the benefit that you're receiving. And it seems that the very real consensus is that at least on the four lower Snake River dams, it might not be. And so that seems to be the trend. And this ruling doesn't mandate that any dams come out, but it at least opens the door to the conversation that what we're doing is currently insufficient, and we have to explore all of our options.
Now, I was under the impression in the last couple of decisions that there was still talk. I mean, actually, there was one where the dams, there was one under the Bush administration where the dams were considered a part of nature. That was back in the early part of the, like 2002, 2003.
Right.
That was the worst of the decisions, or the worst of the plans. But I think under the ruling that came as a response to the first plan that came out under the Clinton administration was that breaching should be considered. And I'm wondering, I know that you haven't been around here that long, but I'm wondering what makes this judge's decision make breaching more of a likely possibility than it was back in 2000?
Well, I think it goes back to a couple things that I kind of touched on there as far as the cost of retrofitting those dams to be able to actually improve is probably it's potentially higher than the cost of removing those dams. And also, Judge Simon in his ruling kind of very explicitly laid out that for the past several decades, we've been operating under this standard of trending towards recovery. And it just means that if, you have an endangered species listed species, as long as they are, trending towards recovery, your plan is basically working. Well, a lot of these fish they'd been decimated so badly that, even the slightest improvement was a trend towards recovery. But he points out that over decades, the response has not even been that great as far as populations go. And so he kind of said that that we've been operating under this trending towards recovery. And yes, we're trending that way, but it's not happening fast enough, and not enough is being done. And so, we kind of look at it as this ruling was strongly worded, and it was decisive, and there's just kind of no two ways about it. Rejected it back. They've got to redraw up the plan and come back in 2018, and hopefully we'll see some improvements.
So is the concept of trending towards recovery being removed, maybe trending being placed by showing dramatic signs of recovery?
Well, it's kind of getting that time, isn't it?
But I'm wondering if that's in the judge's decision. Has he taken that language out of trending towards recovery?
I don't know. I know that he referenced the trending towards recovery language, which I believe is part of the Endangered Species Act. And so he basically said that, yeah, we're moving that way, but we're not moving fast enough. And it's time that, they say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, right? I think that's very true. I know it's a cliche, but it's very true in this case. You keep doing the same things over and over again, and then a lot of our runs are still just teetering on, one or two bad years and they may be gone. And so it's time to actually do something meaningful.
Well, before we talk more about the specifics of this latest judge's ruling, I wanted to talk a little bit more about why the Snake River dams in particular are well, both so dangerous to the salmon and so unnecessary to humans. And I guess one of the differences I understand between the reservoirs in the Columbia River, the backwaters from the dams, is that they're deeper than on the Salmon River, and so therefore they're cooler. So I wanted to talk a bit about why it's so hard for salmon to get past those four dams, both coming and going on the river.
Well, some of the reason is that it's further up, and a lot of the, I know at least a lot of the runs that go up that way are sockeye, endangered sockeye that run up that far. And sockeye are a summer running fish, and so you have much more of a chance for the water to increase to lethal levels for those fish just due to the time of the year that they run.
I mean, it's also quite a bit hotter in Idaho.
Yes.
I mean, it's hot in eastern Oregon.
Yes.
I remember sitting by the Snake River in Weezer, Idaho, back when I was young and just moved out from the East Coast, and I was amazed at how hot it was.
Yes.
in what I thought was, you know, the cool Northwest. So that's one issue, is the temperature. And
yes.
Then also, isn't it an issue too with the size of the river? I mean, the Snake River, though it's a mighty river for Idaho, is not anywhere like the size of the Columbia River.
Significantly smaller than the Columbia. I think the issues just kind of go back to the to temperature and the actual fish passage at the dams. Not up to speed on all the dams on the Snake River system, but I know at least some of them might not be quite up to our current standards of allowing, like the fish ladders, allowing fish to get around.
It's kind of weird because actually the Snake River dams are all newer than every dam on the Columbia River. And,
oh.
And several of the Snake River dams, I was here when they went in. I think when I moved here, they had built one, they were building a second one, and then the others went in the 70s and 80s.
Hmm.
So it's, you'd think they would have had better technology. And
well, it's just kind of back to that, yeah, you would think so. But it kind of goes back to that cost benefit of, I mean, certainly the Bonneville Dam is massive and provides a lot of energy, you know, relatively clean energy to an entire region. And if you look at, you know, that versus a smaller dam that might not necessarily be producing as much energy or providing as much of a kind of public service, then you have to start considering the options of is it necessary and how much good is it providing?
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the latest court decision that could move us towards removing those infamous four dams on the Lower Snake River and improving salmon passage. My guest is Dan Cherry, who's the communications director for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. Well, talking about the usefulness of those dams, that's one of the things that I, when I started studying dams and doing projects about them, I tried to figure out, well, what are those four dams on the Snake River for?
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically touted for power generation, irrigation, and navigation.
Right.
So I found out pretty early, they don't generate much power. I forget what the percentage is, but it's like, you know, under 10% of the power that's generated on the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
It's even, I mean, it's negligible. And
right.
You take those offline, you wouldn't notice at all in terms of electrical generation. In irrigation, I, to my surprise, learned they don't generate much irrigation. So then the answer was navigation, because they make Lewiston, Idaho, an inland seaport. So I was arranging to take a tugboat ride up the Columbia River when I was doing this documentary about 14 years ago. And I talked to Tidewater Barge, and I was wanting to ride the tugboat all the way from the Bonneville Dam to Lewiston.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that there aren't very many barges that go all the way up to Lewiston. In fact, there was like less than one a week. So I basically got to go from the Bonneville Dam to the Dalles Dam, which took a good part of the day anyway, and it was interesting. But I was interested to see how little barge traffic, I mean, even the stuff getting up past McNary Dam is pretty small. Most of that barge traffic goes to the Dalles. So it turns out it doesn't seem like they do much for navigation either. So why are they there?
beats me. We are definitely looking at this, and in that you brought up something that I had meant to say earlier, that at least anecdotally I've come to understand that the barge traffic has decreased significantly. It used to be a lot more utilized as far as getting grains and or all other kinds of goods up and down the river, and now barge traffic has dropped down to the point to where you kind of start to question, well, how necessary are the locks and the dams there? But why they're still there? Well, honestly, politics has a lot to do with it. A lot of and those dams are operated by the Bonneville Power Administration.
Actually, they're the Bureau of Reclamation, aren't they? The Bureau of Reclamation.
Yeah, you could be right on that. I'm sorry.
Army Corps of Engineers.
Corps of Engineers. Yes. And which is a federal agency, and all of these things are, you know, kind of somewhat dictated by the winds of politics. And for a lot of politicians, dam removal is certainly a four-letter word, and it's not even, you know, it's a non-starter. We saw in the Klamath Agreement just a few months ago, you saw stakeholders from across the region, the, you know, businesses, agriculture, tribes, fishermen, all of the above, come together, come to work for years, come to an agreement, and everyone made a lot of compromises. But part of the deal was removal of the dams that blocked fish passage. And all it required was a simple approval of Congress to approve what local governments had already put in place, had already agreed on. And then it gets to Congress, and our senators, Wyden and Merkley, do their part and get the Senate to pass a bill, and then it just sat in the House, and Congressman Walden blocked it, more or less. All on account of, well, speculation, but it's pretty easy speculation to say all on account of dam removal.
Now, aren't those dams going to be removed finally, or at least?
Yes. They came back after the fact, and the states and some federal agencies and everyone found a way to bypass Congress because
it's the only way you can do anything these days.
To get anything done these days, you have to bypass Congress. Apparently, even something that's as simple as approving a local plan. So you hear a lot of politicians talk about how that federal government gets in the way of locals and you know, federal government intrusion. And I think that that kind of looked like a shining example of federal government intrusion into local governance.
Well, before the show, Chris Andre was running did an interview about the oil trains.
Yes.
And a lot of people in this region, I think, are currently coupling the Columbia River and oil trains and seeing the oil trains as the biggest hazard that the river's ever faced. And while the biggest hazard is probably Hanford when you start getting into it. But the oil trains can remind us of all the other poisons that are upstream. But I'd like to go back and look at the history of hazards on the Columbia River, because when we start talking about the dam removal on the Snake River, it sort of brings up a kind of a hidden history. Mm-hmm. There's a lot actually hidden under those surfaces of those reservoirs. And there's a lot about the Northwest that people who've just moved here don't have any idea about. So I wanted to talk about how the dams transformed the Columbia Snake system, and how that maybe is actually the foreshadowing of this latest industrial move, which is to turn the Columbia River Basin into a fossil fuel transport corridor.
Yeah, it just from now, I'm a fish guy, but but just from, you know, all the Woody Guthrie songs and the everything in the 30s and the 40s, we got pretty crazy about dams in this region, where it was just kind of like at the time, a cheap means of producing electricity, and also provided means of navigation and all the other quote unquote benefits of the time. And then now we come back, you know, years later, and we see that, oh, actually there are negative impacts of doing this. And so you start looking at it through a different lens. But the oil trains are certainly the kind of the talk right now. And it has many people people who live nearby the tracks, and it has a lot of anglers and other users of the river kind of debating the merits of doing that. And I think that the most recent accident kind of just...
The one in Mosier.
Yes, the one in Mosier, yes. I guess not the most recent accident.
Actually, they dumped a bunch of diesel oil in Troutdale and into the Sandy River last weekend. So
yeah, that's why you got to clarify. Yeah, hard keeping track these days.
Good old United Union Pacific. I mean, it's...
But it definitely has people thinking about, is it worthwhile to keep doing this thing? What's the potential impact on our beloved fisheries? You know, I know a lot of anglers were out there on the river and heard the news that day. And I know that they thought, well, what if, you know, what if I had to deal with an oil slick coming down the river right now or something? So it's
actually, you could be fishing on the Columbia River and have an oil train go within feet of you.
Oh, yes.
And if it had derailed right where you're fishing.
Oh, yeah.
That would, the least of your problems would have been, you know, whether you're going to catch any fish that day.
That's true. But yeah, it at least has people thinking and it has people talking. And I know with politics, fossil fuels and especially oil are sometimes it's hard to get people to think and talk about it because they have their ideas and they're ingrained in that. And this at least has people moving in that direction as far as talking about it and reassessing the necessity of this and assessing the benefits of having oil trains come right through.
So I think in a way, I almost feel like the mentality that built all those dams starting in the 30s is the same mentality that's now bringing oil trains through. I wonder if that resonates for you.
I guess you could draw some parallels.
Actually, I will say one thing different, because I think that people were thinking, I mean, Roosevelt's whole thing about building all those dams was that it was going to electrify rural areas. It was going to improve the living standards and conditions for all kinds of impoverished people in the West. And they didn't think about the fish. I mean, I think some people, I think there was some thinking about the fish, but it wasn't, there was at least, the. It wasn't just a fake gesture of concern for people's needs. It was, I think, a real serious concern of addressing what they thought were important needs.
Right.
I think that the oil trains are not serving anybody's needs except for the profits of the oil companies and the railroads. And the other thing that's interesting is, I was at a meeting last night where I was learning that even President Obama can't stop the oil trains. Only the railroads can stop the oil trains. It's the railroads have a certain kind of power invested in them that supersedes government control. So that is, I mean, that's, I think we're dealing with even a harder playing field. At least with the dams, you can address the government. And if we had a different Congress, things might actually go through a little bit more smoothly.
Yeah, that's a statement that you could say just about anything in federal politics these days. That if we had a different Congress, things might go a little more smoothly. but yeah, I do agree that, I mean, you think back even to the 1800s, the turn of the century, when railroads just had immense control over politics on the local, state, and federal levels. They were very well funded, and I think we still see some of that still exists. But we also see some moves in the other direction these days too. I mean, you see that the Mosier Oil Train situation, you know, Washington was holding hearings on the oil trains, you know, with the governor, and now the governor, I believe, put out a statement the other day saying that maybe this isn't the best idea.
Yeah, I think he's joined Kate Brown and all the entire Oregon delegation, which I think even includes Greg Walton, in calling for a moratorium on oil trains. It was, first of all, moratorium until it could be proved safe, but I think actually there's more and more stipulations.
Right.
And I think that, and I think ODOT actually called for sending oil trains through the Northwest. So things are definitely moving there. Getting back to dams, do you see that whole, I mean, if we can rise up and go, we care about our region, we care about the river, we care about the fish, we care about the people who live along the river. We cannot be sending dangerous cargo that can easily be derailed and cause massive explosions through this very precious place. Now we look back into the river itself, we see these dams plugging the river. Do you think there's an extension to that in looking at, well, what will make this river healthy, and how do we go forward to make this river a really healthy river system?
Well, I think In a perfect world, everyone cares about fish as much as I do, and the people that I, you know, fish with. We all care very deeply about it. But I think that for the average kind of like person who is not deeply involved in environmental policy and is not and is kind of a non-angler, they don't necessarily see the Columbia River system as being an unhealthy place. I mean, it looks great. You can go recreate there. Everything looks fine. And then something like the oil train happens and people say, oh, wow, this is a threat to public health. And you get action on that. fish health and river health is something that's a little different, because like it's when you have something happen like that, it's far too late to actually repair what you've done in any short period of time. And so the people who know, you know, about rivers and river health, like, you know, that it is a very slow moving kind of process, and it's hard to get public opinion swayed that quickly to do something. And I lost my train of thought.
Well, that's okay. Well, I was actually wanting to talk specifically about what's making this decision different from the previous decisions, and why. I mean, this was the first one where it was really, this is good news for the salmon. I think that's the heading for a lot of emails that I got. Mm-hmm. The other ones was more like, we're going in the right direction, but we'll see what happens. Why do you think, or do you think, that this decision will actually generate a plan that makes sense and that could actually lead to breaching the Snake River dams?
I I believe both headlines. I believe that it is good for salmon, and I believe that it is also moving in the right direction, at least trending that way. I don't know if we're going to see dam removal in any short order. I don't know. There's a lot of politics involved there. There's a lot of, a lot of people stake their livelihoods off of that, and they're going to have a voice in this too, certainly.
Actually, if they removed that, was it the, I never remember the name of them in order. I think it's the Granite Dam, the one that's right near Lewiston. I
mean, Lower Granite, maybe?
Lower Granite, yeah. That if they remove that dam, they could remove that massive Berlin Wall that blocks Lewiston from the river.
Yes.
And it would maybe make Lewiston a really nice destination, riverport destination, as opposed to being feeling like it's East Germany, which is what it feels like right now, or East Berlin.
Right. I think that ties into a greater point that when we have a healthy river, when we have a healthy river system and we have healthy runs of fish, it really does wonders for our more sustainable industries, as far as sustainable recreational fishing, which draws in billions of dollars annually into just people being able to come from across the country and all over the world to have a shot at harvesting one of the Northwest's, you know, iconic fish. And then you look at the benefits of tourism and the other parts of the outdoor recreation economy, and you start to break it down and you think about the overall impact of the economy, and you start to wonder if, well, are the dams there because they're there, or are they there because if we actually do reap the benefits of improving fish passage and turning things back into the way that they were until we came along and bottled it up, maybe the benefits of that are greater as far as, you know, increasing our tourism, increasing our recreation opportunities. And so if you look at it through that lens, it kind of gives more credence to returning the river to the way it should be.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Cherry, who's Communications Director for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. And we're talking about a decision last month by U.S. District Judge Michael Simon to send back the latest federal fish salmon recovery plan back to the drawing board and to make it actually work this time. This is the fifth time around, I do believe. Dan and I were trying to remember before the show started how many times it's been sent back, but it's been so many times.
Several.
That it makes you really, this is the definition of insanity, as you just described in the beginning of the show. I wanted to talk a little bit about NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Right.
What does it mean that he says it must follow NEPA?
Well, so NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, like you said, is a federal law that says that federal agencies have to conduct an environmental impact study before they go on operating a plan that would impact the environment. And that impact study has to basically prove that the gains of doing such a practice outweighs the cost of doing that. And this is, the judge kind of used NEPA to throw it back, as far as like, that's why the biological opinion is there, as far as saying like, we operate these dams, or this is our plan for growing wild runs of salmon and steelhead. And the plan was inadequate. as we see.
So were the other decisions, did they make any reference to the National Environment Policy Act, or is this the first time it's being specifically called out?
You know, I can't say. I wasn't involved in any of the previous decisions, so I'm not sure about that.
Because I'm curious, because, I mean, that does have a lot of teeth. And
Yes.
That's one of the advantages, actually, that Washington State, California, and Montana have over Oregon, that they have state versions of that, whereas, ironically, here in Green Oregon, we don't. So it means there's a certain issues, like, for instance, like the oil trains, there's a better chance, actually, of stopping them at the state level in Washington because they have a state environmental policy act.
Oh, I see.
But, I guess the last thing I wanted to talk about is what it would really entail to breach the dams. I mean, this has been a fantasy. I've been hearing about this fantasy since the 80s, probably since the last dam was built in the Snake River. Would the dams be taken out totally, or would they just be like the center of them, the turbine and the power stations taken out?
I think that that's probably a case-by-case basis based on the type of dam and what it takes. I'm certainly not smart enough to be an engineer. But there are other ways to potentially achieve the goal of improving fish passage. We've seen tremendous effects of using more spill. And like I said before, we got an injunction to use more spill, and that increased things as well. So I guess everything will be looked at now, which is, I guess, the right way to go about it, as far as maybe breaching completely is the way to go, maybe breaching partially is the way to go, or maybe just more spill is going to accomplish it, and that would be the most beneficial way.
But the spill is only helping the smolts get down.
Right.
And then there's some issues. Also, I know that they have to be very careful with the force of the water as it hits the spill, as it hits the surface of the river, because if there's too much, whatever gives the fish the bends. And I mean, so you can kill fish even if they're spilling.
Yeah. And even if you're spilling into a tail race of a dam, you still have increased populations of the pike minnow and everything that are down there waiting on them. So
not to mention the seals.
And
the,
yeah, right. Always.
And the cormorants.
Always.
I know the cormorants are a problem at the mouth of the river.
Right, yes.
It's a little bit of an aside, because I had Bob Salinger on from the Audubon Society last week. We were talking about this whole project they have, that the Wildlife Services has, very badly named agency, the Wildlife Murderers Association,
sure.
Basically, Federal Wildlife Murderers. But they, their massive killing of the cormorants at the mouth of the Columbia River. And it really looks like one of the things that Bob talked about is that, you know, they want to blame the cormorants. And a few years ago, they were blaming the seals at the Bonneville Dam.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to look at all the kinds of depredation to the habitat all along the course of the river, and of course the biggest one being the dams.
Correct.
And I wonder if we can focus on the dams, if maybe we can save the cormorant.
It's a touchy subject, because we have seen the dams and other structures, that other changes that humans have made to the river, have given some species kind of a leg up over where they wouldn't have had that leg up before. Seals and sea lions, you know, are killing a lot of native sturgeon in the Bonneville Pool down below Bonneville, and they're doing a lot of harm, and cormorants are eating literally tons of outmigrating smolts every year. And you have to, it's easy to demonize a couple species that are kind of taking advantage of conditions that we've made for them. And I think that where people kind of go wrong on that is that in a lot of ways, salmon and steelhead are kind of like our canary in the coal mine, in that when they're doing well, you know that the environment's doing well, and you're doing the things to help them survive. And when they're not doing well, you know that there's also a bigger problem. And so just by focusing on wildlife mitigation is an incomplete solution to a much bigger problem.
And it does seem to be, to me, it seems like it's part of this disconnect that we as humans have to the rest of the other species we share the planet with. I'm thinking about like the problem with the spotted owl,
mm-hmm.
very far away from fishing. But in the spotted, they discovered a few years ago that part of the problem with spotted owl recovery was that barred owls were moving into habitat that had once been just spotted owl, and that they were basically eradicating the spotted owl. So Fish and Wildlife's great idea was, let's kill the barred owls.
Right.
And instead of looking at how much more we've encroached on spotted owl territory than the barred owls have, and I feel the same way about the cormorants and the Caspian terns and the other birds that are being demonized, and the way that we will... Actually, I'm thinking we're doing a show next week about coyotes, another demonized species.
Yeah.
And we demonize the predators, the vermin predators, rather than looking at our own behavior. And I'm wondering, how do we start to reflect back at what we've done that's made all these imbalances become really out of control? And what responsibility do we have as the instigators of the imbalance to try to restore balance?
That's another tough one, because that involves kind of a shift in mindset, and that kind of thing rarely happens quickly because you don't have the kind of event to change public opinion that quickly. And so most people are probably unaware that this kind of stuff goes on. You know, it's only the people that are really involved in river activities or environmental stuff that know. And I think that it is going to involve a complete change of mentality as far as, the cormorants are getting out of control. Better just go shoot some cormorants, instead of asking, well, how did they get control? How did they get out of control in the first place? What have we done? I mean, and I think that what we're not taking into account is that when the river's free flowing, it floods and it washes out those islands, and the cormorants don't have as much habitat, and they don't necessarily blow up to the populations to what we see today. So when you look at it from a balanced approach, you kind of see, well, you know, there's more going on here. It's not as simple as, well, we screwed this up, but we can fix it just by killing the cormorants. there's more to it. And so that's the difficult part, is getting people and getting our local and federal governments to understand that, you know, dam removal, habitat restoration, ocean health, river health, they're all their own distinct little part of the puzzle. But one of those by itself is incomplete, and it doesn't make up any part of a solution.
Well, one last question.
Yes.
I was thinking about this as I was driving into the station, and I heard the show being announced, and all they mentioned is that I was speaking with the communications director for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. They didn't say what the topic was. And I thought, people are going to be wondering, why is she talking to him? So,
right.
And I think a lot of my listeners, probably when they think about salmon issues or they think about coal trains, they're going to think about quote, environmental groups, or they're going to think about the tribes. So what role, why are you as a sports fisherman so invested in preserving, well, obviously why you're invested in preserving salmon runs, but what is your perspective, your particular perspective, and why does that maybe broaden the whole base of people who are really needed to support the protection of the river system?
Yeah, I think a lot of times there's a disconnect between kind of the whole sportsman-minded person and the environmentally-minded person. And really, I think that we have a lot more in common than what sometimes we give each other credit for. In that a lot of times, you know, recreational anglers and hunters are some of the biggest advocates for wildlife and habitat restoration and doing all the things to preserve the species that we enjoy and want to be able to have those around to be able to harvest in a very sustainable manner. And so I know on a personal level, I care deeply about fish runs, because fishing is an enormous part of my life, and I am better for it, and it's something that, you know, brings me more joy than anything else. And because of that, I care about fish deeply, and I want to make sure that they're going to be around for my children and my grandchildren to have around. And I think that's a common theme that you'll find with a lot of recreational anglers, that they feel the same way, that they would sacrifice for the good of the fish overall. I'm not saying that everyone is like that, but the majority of the people are like that. And it's the recreational anglers who do more as far as, you know, the licensing fees, that all of that goes back into habitat restoration. And they spend more money towards benefiting fish than what most other groups do. And so that's why we're here today, and that's why we care about this.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us,
Thank
Dan.
You very much.
We've been talking this morning with Dan Cherry, who's Communications Director for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, You can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll be talking more about oil trains that are running through the gorge in the aftermath of the train derailment in Mosier 3 weeks ago. My guests are going to be climate change activist Bonnie McKinley and Mosier Mayor Arlene Burns. My engineer is Natasha Delapine. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Robbie Robertson and Primo and Mike. Thanks for listening.
Wichitanto gimme wa huani ko hurane yana ne no. Wichitanto gimme wa huani ko hurane yana ne no we. Wichitanto gimme wa huani ko hurane yana ne no. Wichitanto gimme wa huani ko hurane huani ko hurane huani ko hurane. Wichitanto gimme wa huani ko hurane.